Going out on the water is my favorite kind of day. Hey, look, it's an albatross is a great thing to say.
Thank you for tuning in to Hannah and Eric Go Birding, a podcast by birders for birders.
I'm Hannah and he's Eric.
We created this podcast to share adventures, sometimes misadventures, and opinions that we have on different birding topics. We're definitely not experts, and anything that we discuss that might be controversial, I want you to remember, they're our own opinions, and they might be different from yours. I thought you were going to, like, with that song, I saw the lyrics written down, I thought you were going to go, hey, look, it's an albatross.
Well, I'm sorry.
It's a good thing to say.
Do you want me to redo it?
No, I liked the way you did it. I was bracing myself for, like, a shock, like a, hey!
Like I was going to poke you?
Yeah. Yeah, you're like... Like, give me, like, a good, like, word jab.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Exactly.
A word jab in my ear hole. that's like your ears, you know?
Need a t-shirt that says that. Ear jab in your ear hole. Anyways. So, this week, actually today when we're recording, kicks off International Dark Sky Week.
Yeah, so it'll have been going on for 2 days. When this episode gets released.
Yeah, so it's April 2nd through the 8th of 2024, and it concludes with the Great North American Eclipse, which happens on April 8th, not anywhere near where we're at. It goes up through Texas and up to the Northeast, so we're going to miss it. But if you get a chance to see some of it, you know, it'd be super cool. Eric, why are dark skies important?
So you, like, really throw that at me really quick, didn't you?
Gotta put you on the spot.
It just put me on the spot. So dark skies are super important for lots of different things. So, like, for mammals, our circadian rhythm is controlled not entirely, but very much so by the amount of light and dark cycle that we have. So birds have the same sort of thing. They deal with a light-dark cycle. We have migrating birds at night, obviously. Dark sky gets all messed up because of light pollution, and they can't see what they need to see to go where they're going, or maybe something brightens up and causes them to go off track or something. You also have arthropods and insects get affected by too many bright lights at night. So that's food for birds. So there's tons and tons of different reasons why, from my view of nature and what I look at in nature, is really heavily affected by dark skies not being dark enough.
Yeah, and there's also a lot of research, too, like you were mentioning with mammals. Like, there's a lot of research about humans and how dark skies are important for us for a number of different reasons. You know, it can contribute to your happiness or lack of happiness, depending on whether you have dark skies or not. Sleep cycle, like Eric mentioned. There's a number of different impacts that it can have. And we actually did an episode about International Dark Skies, the association or the organization, a couple years ago. We'll put that in the show notes. So if you want to find out more about dark skies, you can check that out. But it's becoming a more and more popular topic, which is really cool because I love being able to see the stars. I particularly love it more when it's a little warmer out and it's easier to sit outside and enjoy the dark skies. But I know where we live, we get some beautiful night skies.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So. Cannon Beach has got a pretty good night sky. It's not pristine, but it's pretty darn good. You see, it's like, I think with the naked eye, we can see like four stars across Orion's belt, and it's a really nice dark sky in general, but it could always be better. There's definitely some places for improvement in our community, and every community is that way. There's always places for improvement of making your dark sky darker and more, not necessarily just darkening everything down, but making lights more purposeful.
Yeah, directional.
Directional, purposeful, doing their job, saving you money on electricity, saving you money on waste, and then also just making the night sky better.
Yeah, definitely. So we'll throw some resources in the show notes if you want to learn more about dark skies. But other than that, it's the week to celebrate it. So
celebrate
let's
celebrate dark skies.
Merry Dark Sky Week.
Yes.
Another event that's coming up on May 11th is the Global Big Day.
Yeah, just over a month away. We got to get ready. Got to kind of get those the warm ups in. Kind of get prepared to get out there and just bird super hard on the 11th, or just bird regular on the 11th. You know,
yeah,
whichever floats your boat.
Bird however you want. And we'll be putting together a team as we have the last couple of years for the Global Big Day. So check out our Facebook and all that, and we'll get some information out there so you can participate. It's really easy. You don't have to pay anything. All you have to do is go birding for You know, I think it's 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Make an eBird checklist or make multiple, and then you'll just submit it to our team name, and then we'll see how many birds that we can get across the world. One other business item that we want to mention is that we still have the dial-a-birder. Mm-hmm. So if you want to call this number and, you know, ask us a question or tell us what's going on in your birding community or share any kind of birding information with us, you can definitely do that. The phone number there is 503-741-9306.
Yeah. So dial that if you want to dial a birder and ask a question or tell a story on a voicemail. So upcoming podcasts, Hannah does another podcast, two other podcasts, actually, Women Birders Happy Hour and Bird Nerd Book Club. Last week, Bird Nerd Book Club came out. What book did you read and who did you interview?
So I read The Nighthawk's Evening, Notes of a Field Biologist, which was written by Gretchen Newberry. And the funny thing about talking with Gretchen is that she and I actually went to Oregon State University at the same time. So we overlapped.
Dr. Duggar?
Yeah, we weren't in the same class or anything that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
But that was just super cool. And it was fun to talk with her about nighthawks and their biology and how they've adapted to human landscapes and in that. So you can, that episode came out on March 28th, and you can find that anywhere you listen to podcasts.
And then next week, you've got Women Birders Happy Hour. You talk to a woman birder. Who'd you talk to?
So I talked to Jen Hodge, who is the coordinator for the San Diego Bird Festival.
Oh, yeah.
And the episode will come out on April 11th. And it was so much fun to learn about her because, you know, we meet Jen and talk with her when we're at the San Diego Bird Festival. But everything is – there's so much going on that we don't get really a chance to, like – you know, talk about anything. Yeah. And so it's
festival time and she's the coordinator of the festival. So yeah. It is like, that is crunch time, the biggest week.
It's like, bride at her wedding, you know, like just don't bother her with stuff unless it's absolutely necessary. So it was a lot of fun to talk with Jen and actually learn more about her. So we're going a couple places soon.
Yes,
Eric,
we are.
You want to tell them about that?
Yes. So in a couple of weeks, 2 weeks out, I think, 3 weeks out, we're going to Spring Chirp in Weslaco, Texas, down in the Rio Grande Valley, April 17th to the 20th, to the boutique festival that they have down there. We are going on that repositioning cruise from Princess, May 7th to the 11th, LA to Vancouver. I think there's still berths available.
Probably.
On that. Yeah. So there's no port to call, but it's a bunch of days at sea. Get to, I think, 3 days out at distance that we'll be out there in the ocean.
And it's potential to see three different species of petrel.
Yeah. Very, very excited about that. And also albatross and shearwaters and...
Sure. And, yeah. All those other ones.
All the other potential exciting things that are out there. The end of May, the May 30th to June 2nd, Dean Hale Woodpecker Festival in Sisters, Oregon, which is Central Oregon. Not that far away from us. We just drive right up the road and we're there. Amazon Burning Expedition Brazil for Women. Hannah is going in September to that. Mid-September, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, very excited to go check that out. It'll be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And then our most exciting news we haven't talked about on the podcast yet, but we posted it on Facebook, is the Flock to Marion cruise. As of yesterday, the April 1st.
April 2nd.
It was April 2nd. Yeah, April 2nd. The
time change and everything.
Time change. April 2nd in South Africa. They opened up to everyone that's a BirdLife South Africa member, which we are. We pay membership to that, so we're BirdLife South Africa members. So they opened up berths for anybody like that to book. We tried to book ours. We're still in the middle of trying to book ours.
We're in limbo. I'm not sure if we have a room or not.
I know. It's a very expensive phone call.
It's stupid expensive.
Yeah, it's stupid expensive. So,
but also the hours that they're open, like the office is open is like from 11 p.m.
Our
for
time.
Us to like 8 a.m. So I mean, there's not a whole lot of
it's an
overlap.
Expensive phone call that has to happen in the middle of the night. But that's only because we're trying to do that within the pre-booking time.
Sure.
I believe April 14th?
April
15th. 15th is when it'll open up to the general public for anybody that isn't currently a BirdLife South Africa member. And they'll be able to book berths. But very, very excited. Hopefully we can make it work and hopefully we can get down there. But it's near the third week in January of 2025.
And if you haven't listened to our other podcasts about the Flock to Marion, just... real quick, it's a mm-hmm. cruise that's out of Durban, South Africa, back to Durban, South Africa. So it's a 7-day cruise with no stops, and it goes directly to the Marion Island, mm-hmm. which
Prince Edward Island chain. There's two islands there,
but Marion Island is the key one.
That's the key one.
So that's the breeding location for half of all wandering albatross that we have in the world. And it is just an incredible experience to get near these islands and see albatross, which I always think of like semis on a highway mm-hmm. because they're so big compared Huge. To like all these Ooh. Little prions that are like, you know, little cars that are zipping past yeah. you. And it's just an incredible experience to be eye to eye with a wandering albatross. And we saw one individual when we went on the first one that was almost all white. And the guides were telling us that albatross.
Yeah, Peter Harrison was like, this is, they get whiter as they get older. Mm-hmm. They slowly get more and more white, progressively throughout their entire life cycle.
Yeah.
And he commented that this one is very likely at least as old as the oldest people on the ship.
Yeah.
So it's just amazing that there's this bird that's decades old flying around that is just living its life out there. And we just happen upon this old fella flying around.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. So anyways, moving along, we have our April Bird Nerd giveaway.
Yes. The Bird Nerd giveaway. This month we are giving away the Melusine Birds of Many Feathers by Geraldine O'Aid Sessi, and coloring books. So very excited to give that away. It's pretty interesting.
It's collection a great book.
Yeah.
And you know, we kind of thought the coloring books mm-hmm. would be a fun thing, you know, for spring to sit outside and color. Yeah. I know I would like to have time to do that. So if you want to, you know, sit outside and color, then this is a great prize for you. And the deadline is April 16th. Mm-hmm. And what we're asking you to do is to contact us in any way that you would like. You can message or on Facebook or Instagram or email, whatever. We want your answer to this question that I will be asking right now.
Right now, at this very moment.
Which is, what is your favorite thing about spring birding?
Your favorite thing about spring birding?
Yep.
What's your favorite thing about spring birding?
I think it's being able to see like all of the migrants come back. I mean, I feel like I talk about migration a lot, but I think it's so cool that, you know, the swains and thrushes are going to be coming back soon. And what stories have they, you know, would they tell me if they could speak English, about all the incredible things that happened to them while they were in route migration and then in their, you know, non-migratory locations. Mm-hmm. So I think it's cool. It's like seeing a friend again.
Yeah.
What's your favorite thing?
The weather. I just look forward to the weather changing to something else. So
I'm sorry to complain, but we live in the Pacific Northwest.
I'm not complaining. It's there in the winter. It's just pretty much the same every single day. It's overcast and kind of dreary and rainy, and it's not awful. It's just, that's just what it is every day, but it's pretty much the same every single day.
Yeah.
Except for when we get a big storm. So, but we'll go for like all of February where it's just like the same thing every single day. But as soon as we get into March and April, things start changing. The sunsets start getting exciting because you have all these weird textures and patterns in the sky, and you have stuff happening. This, the sky is happening. The birds are out there. You're able to go out there, so you can see the birds. There are most of them. The winter birds are here, but things are changing. It's the changing of stuff.
Okay, yeah, gotcha.
That's the exciting thing for me.
Okay, so tell us your answer by April 16th to be entered to win this prize. So I've always heard that San Diego pelagic trips are great. So, you know, we had to test it out for ourselves.
We last had to, year, yeah, for sure. Yeah. just to test it.
Last year, we had the opportunity to go on it during the San Diego Bird Festival, but it was rained out and stormed out. So, unfortunately, we weren't able to go. And we actually ended up leading a tour that day instead.
Yeah. Which it was interesting because we talked about it last year during our episode, but Jen just said, here's some keys to a van. Go give them the Han and Eric go birding trip. And I was like, oh, okie dokie. Let's figure out where we're going to go.
Yeah, right.
So that was a fun adventure. But this year, we were also slated for the pelagic, and the weather was much nicer.
Definitely.
The weather was not. So they don't typically cancel pelagics because of rain. It's typically canceled because of wind and wind-driven waves mm-hmm. that cause it to be just too much. And last year, there was both rain and wind. So it was the whole thing. It just wasn't good. But this year, no wind, no rain, nice and sunny. It was beautiful weather for a pelagic. And we had our fingers crossed every single day leading up to it. Like, oh, is it going to go? Oh, is it going to go? And every single day kept looking like, oh, it's, yeah. And then it happened. we got to the day and the weather was nice and they were green light, thumbs up, let's go.
That's a point that I want to emphasize about pelagics. So pelagic captains, you know, the boat captain, they're responsible for the safety and the health of all the folks that are on the ship. And so they may cancel it, even though it doesn't look like anything when you're sitting at the marina.
Mm-hmm.
They're paying attention to what's happening like further out into the ocean. And so it may look great and everything and they'll cancel it. And then, you know, it's like, why did they cancel it? Did they just not want to go out? But no, they're there for the health and safety of you and their first mates and deckhands and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the coordinator's call, the bird festival coordinator's call.
Yeah, typically not the guide's call. It's not the festival coordinator. It's the captain of the ship.
Yeah.
They have the final authority on what happens on their boat.
Yeah. So don't be mad at anybody about it because they're just looking out for you.
Yeah. And they usually do know best. If they say it's too rough, it's probably too rough.
Yeah. So the festival trip starts off with paperwork. So we sat in the meeting room and everybody filled out their paperwork. They did a brief little introduction to mm-hmm. what to expect while you're out on the ship. And, you know, as we were sitting there, because we got there early and we were sitting there, filled out the paperwork and people were filing in like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, how many people are going to be on this boat?
I know. It was like, it was a mystery. The checklists ended up showing 61,
really?
I think. Yeah, I guessed 50 based on like thinking how many people, like how many guides they had, because they had five guides. We were kind of guidey-ish, but not really guides.
Yeah.
And then there was five actual pelagic guides that really knew where we were going and what the specific birds were. And then I was thinking like, okay five, probably 50. Cause then you have 10 people per guide is kind of the breakdown that you usually try to aim for during festivals, especially. But like 61 people is what they noted. So that includes guides. So maybe it was 55 participants then.
It's such a crapshoot though with these pelagics, like with how many people are going to be on there, because I mean, you can read the eBird checklist to mm-hmm. see, or you can, you know, if they have notes posted from previous pelagics,
yeah.
But we've been on ships with like 15 people yeah. and then ships with 200 people.
I know you have to either ask a whole bunch of questions in emails
yeah.
or know somebody that's been on with that particular charter. Or just wing it.
Not that I'm complaining at all about the number of people. I just, I never know what to expect and get there. And it's like, we had never seen the ship.
Yeah.
So I didn't know how big it was going to be. So it's just, always interesting to sit there and like try to, you know, kind of count in your head how many people are going to come in.
How many people are going to fit in here? Okay, this room's getting full. Is the boat bigger than the room or is it smaller than this
room? Which you said 50, but that ship did not, we didn't feel cramped anything.
It
there was
not,
tons of space.
Yeah, not cramped at all. There was enough space for all 50 plus.
Yeah, and plenty of access to guides. So that was really handy too.
Absolutely.
So the first leg of the trip, we headed straight out for Mission Bay, and almost immediately we were seeing pelagic species.
Yeah, so the first couple of things, that we had black-vented shearwaters flying around, and we had those guys flying around all day long, which last year, that was the first year that we'd ever seen them. But this year, we saw so many of them on the pelagic. It just kept going and going and going. They were everywhere. And then, interestingly enough, we ended up with two Jaegers almost right off the bat. We were in that first hour, in that first leg, while we're still in nearshore waters, and ended up with both parasitic and Pomerine Jaegers. The parasitic was pretty distant, and it was pretty difficult to identify, but the Pomerine, lots of people got pictures of it. And there was another Jaeger, too, that I think people were trying to make it into a long-tailed, but it never actually got ID'd to species.
Lots of rhinoceros auklets, a lot of non-breeding common murres,
mm-hmm.
which was fun to see that because we see so many of them here where we're at. It's always weird for me to see them in their non-breeding plumage.
Oh, I know. And we're going to start seeing them. We've been seeing them right now, but we'll start seeing them on Haystack Rock in just a couple of days.
And that was about when we got our first lifer.
Yeah, the Scripps murrelet. That was, I guess I should have given a little bit of play up to that. I'd be like, oh, and kind of describe the bird. But Scripps murrelet, that was our lifer, our one lifer that we had on the trip, on the pelagic. But it's a really good, really cool bird. Really kind of a football shaped bird. It almost looks like a football-sized common murre. Mm-hmm. It's got the black. Its head is more pointed. So the common mer is the head's less pointed. It kind of looks like it's got a bill and then a head.
Yeah.
The murrelet, it slides into it like a canvasback's bill, like slides into the head.
Mm-hmm. Has a more narrow,
like a sloped flat forehead
profile.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Basically, like a little football shaped common mer floating around. Black on back, white on the throat and chest. But fantastic to be super excited to see Edlifer fairly early on in the day.
Yeah, that was really exciting. And then we kept on going out, of course, as pelagic trips
as do. As pelagic trips do.
To head out to the lower 9 mile bank. Yeah, which is so, the ridgeline we were going along.
Yeah, so outside of San Diego, there's a target location. They call it the 9 mile bank. It's a 9 mile long ridgeline that runs kind of northwest to southeast. It's almost straight up north and south, but it's slightly angled. And it's like 15 miles, 20 miles offshore or so. And that's basically all pelagics all target some sort of underwater feature. So whether it be a ridge or a cliff or a valley, or there's always something there, because those underwater features is what makes turbulence. It mm-hmm. makes things happen underwater. And whether it be a cliff that causes fish to be able to butt up against it, and then birds are able to go down and get those fish, or if it's a ridgeline, like it causes different turbulence, things for fish to hide in, things for stuff to happen. So there's a lot of stuff happening underwater that we can't see, but the birds know is happening because they're either diving under the water and they're seeing it, or they're just able to tell by the currents, or however they're able to tell what's going on. But there's more fish activity in that area, and fishermen are also a lot of times in those areas mm-hmm. too, just because that's... if there's lots of fish, then that makes sense for them to be there fishing. And the birds are the same way. Fish are there, they're going
to
be there.
Yeah. Well, and so many of these birds have already figured out, you know, that they need to be near the boats. Mm-hmm. And so a couple of the pelagics that we've been on up here in the Northwest will target those fishing boats and go directly out to where the fleet's at. And that's when you find a lot of birds.
Oh, yeah.
And
you'll go along with them for a little while, and then you'll go find another place that maybe they had just left mm-hmm. or they're going to, and just either jump ahead of them or drop back behind them to their previous fishing spot.
Yeah. Yeah, but on this one, we didn't end up seeing any fishing boats.
Not really. It was pretty scarce. It must just not be the right season for fishing out there. But yeah, lots and lots of birds. Tons of gulls. We even had a brown booby.
Yeah.
That flew fairly close.
So it took us about an hour and a half of motoring out there mm-hmm. to get to that ridgeline.
Yeah.
And the day was just like perfect for pelagic.
Pretty much flat.
It was flat and really good weather mm-hmm. and just a little bit chilly, I want to say. So it was like, you know, just enough to like stave off any like ill feelings.
Yeah, it was comfortable. I really enjoyed it. I had my scopolamine patch, which this is the first time that I've been. I think this is the fourth time I've used the patch. The first time that I've had any side effects from it. Normally it's nothing. I just kind of cruise along and maybe a little bit sleepy or a little bit drowsy, but mm-hmm. not really much at all. This time I had some pretty significant dry mouth.
Oh, but, that's right. Yeah. You were going on and on about that.
Yeah. But it's way better than the alternative. So
seriously,
I was happy with the results of, of that. But it was a really flat trip the whole time anyways. So who knows if I would have been fine without it? I don't know. But we got out to the 9 mile, 9 mile ridge or 9 mile bank, headed south on it, kind of rolled around the southern tip of it.
Which one of the guys,
they're just telling us this is where we're going, and you can see it on the map, but when you're out there, it's just motoring along.
I know. I never know how they.
Yeah, they'll call out as we're going along. Oh, we're turning around the bottom of the tip or the tip of the ridge, and they'll just be saying stuff like that. It's like, if you say so. I don't know. We're just driving.
But one of the guides was telling us something really interesting. You'll have to like get all the facts right about how some of the islands, because we got down to the Mexico-American border mm-hmm. and there were some islands just off of it. And he was saying that some of the islands that are south of the Mexican border in California, but then there's islands that are further out to sea that are north of the border that are in Mexico. Yeah. It like makes a hook shape.
It makes like a weird hook shape. And then also LA County and San Diego County, or Orange County and I think it was Orange County and San Diego County. There was some other counties where that's like south of San Diego County, there's islands that were technically in the county just north.
Oh.
There was some interesting thing about that. So like the offshore geography just off of Southern California is really interesting in terms of California to Mexico and then different counties within California, mm-hmm. like where their borders are drawn. So it was kind of interesting hearing all that. And they were naming off the names of the islands, and there was like 30 of them they named off. And it was like, yeah. These are too many islands for me to remember now.
Well, and some of them were just military, like testing islands or military,
military sites and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So we couldn't get there, but I think one of them had goats previously, and it was like goats had been eradicated off the island. And I know there's a number of islands like that, but it's always fascinating to hear about. So as we started going back up, we had a lot of rhinoceros auklets and a couple Cassin's auklets. So it's always fun to see those birds out there because you don't get to see auklets a whole lot. And they're so fun.
Yeah. So we ended up spending a good 3 hours or so on the ridge itself. So just kind of cruising south and then turned around the bottom of it, hooked around the bottom and headed up the west edge of the ridge. And there wasn't a huge variety. It wasn't like 30 or 40 different pelagic species. I think it was still in the single digits, eight, nine, something like that, of pelagic species. A handful of things like Western gull, Heerman's gull, herring gull.
That's what I was going to mention is that I hadn't really ever thought of this because, you know, we've been on a number of pelagic trips and usually they have the fish oil or whatever that compound is that they're like letting off into the back to attract the gulls.
Yeah, just like putting an oil slick out. Yeah.
Yeah. And they usually have popcorn with it so that it floats and doesn't just, you know, immediately disperse off. But this time they just had popcorn that they were tossing off. And I think, you know, that they were using it as a marker so the gulls know to come find it. And it also just, you know, it attracted them. But some of the gulls, there was a diversity of gulls that were following the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, somebody was trying to find the Heerman's gull in it. And so I hadn't really ever done this when we're like on a pelagic, but just really paying attention to the gulls that are tailing us and the diversity of species in that. And, you know, that's a great way to look at the gulls in a different landscape than you're normally used to, because like here, you know, we usually see them on the shore,
yeah,
obviously, and they're just walking around, and so you don't see them in flight so much. So that was a great way to compare them up close.
Yeah.
And we, you know, picked out the Heerman's gull, which was really iconic with like that bright red bill, and they're just such a beautiful gull with a white head that's amber into their body. And, you know, telling that apart from like the Western gulls that are have much more white on them and are bigger.
Yeah.
So that was a really interesting, one of the guides was talking more about it and trying to get that individual on the different gull species. So yeah, that was a great little education that I didn't expect.
Well, that and the young Heerman's gull and the old Heerman's gull were flying around. So you had the young, which is like just the pure chocolatey, the chocolatey gull. And then you have the adult, which looks completely different, looks like a whole different gull. So definitely lots of fun. So we finished up what we basically... not like quote unquote finished up. We just ran out of time and it was time to start heading back. So on our way back in, we were basically headed back into La Jolla Cove essentially. So that's as far north as we went, as we were running that ridge line north and south. We're headed straight in. There was only like one more species on the way in that was super notable. The parasitic Jaeger that got super close to the boat, not close enough to like get a full frame photo, but it was close enough that it was a big, relatively big bird flying by. That was super cool. But a handful of the black-finned shearwaters and the common murres, a couple more scrips murrelets, which I just kept wanting to see those. Like,
oh, I know.
The little football-shaped murre, like murre-colored murrelet.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's so exciting to see a new pelagic too. Because, you know, the more and more you go out on pelagic trips, as with any birding, the rarer and rarer lifers are going to be. And I didn't really anticipate getting anything on this one. So that Scripps was a surprise for me. That was exciting.
Yeah. So we worked our way in. We got to probably, I don't know, 5 miles offshore, mm-hmm. relatively close where shore was large. And then that's when we started to head south. We started getting more of the inshore species.
Yeah, so we were seeing more like brown pelicans and some of the different species of cormorants. And that's one of the interesting things about going on pelagic trips. I'm just going to talk about pelagic trips. But, you know, there's a lot of variation depending on the distance from shore that you get and mm-hmm. what species you'll see and the diversity that you'll see as you get, you know, a mile out, 2 miles out, 5-10 miles out.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to watch as you're getting closer to shore and how that diversity of species changes, and you get closer and, you know, those sheer waters are becoming fewer and fewer, and then you kind of get into the auklets. Pelicans
get more.
Yeah, and then the pelicans and the cormorants, and then that...
In the exact opposite direction is how they were, like, and you're remembering as you're going back and you're like, oh, just 3 hours ago we were looking at these numbers changing, and now they're changing the exact opposite order.
But also going back. Time of day makes a big deal there too, or mm-hmm. is a point too, because normally, well, I mean, obviously anytime you go out, you're going to be earlier than when you get back in.
What? I time travel when I go on a pelagic.
Stop. But when you go out really early in the morning, mm-hmm. then, you know, not everything has woken up, and you get to see. And so in the afternoon, they're fishing a little bit more. And so you'll see more and more individuals, these species. So that gets us to where we start coming into the mouth of the river. Mm-hmm. And along the edges of the canal, you get the spotted sandpipers and black turnstones. And mm-hmm. you start seeing more of those shorebirds. As well as, you know, the things that hang out in the river mouth.
Yeah, I think there was a couple surf birds as mm-hmm. well. They're just like these little tiny guys that are hanging out on the jetties. And in between the two jetties, you have the things that are usually within the fresher-ish water.
Yeah.
The red-throated loon, common loon, lots of Brandt's cormorants.
Yeah.
And tons of brown pelicans. So like all the things that you would see from land, you start seeing those again, and it's kind of like, oh, I guess this trip's over, isn't it? I guess we're finishing up.
Which is definitely the downside. But, you know, it was a really fun pelagic. Mm-hmm. We had the chance to talk with a lot of folks, and Dan was one of our guides on it.
Yes,
and
he was.
Dan's great, as well as the other guys that were on there. Dave kind of hung out in the back, and he gave us a lot of great information about the geology of the mountain range that's in there too, that I can't remember a thing about, but it was fascinating at the time he was telling us about it. So I need to record him to get all of the great information.
I know, seriously.
That he had. But some of these leaders at this festival, like Paul Lehman and Dave and Dan and Nancy, they have been doing this pelagic for so long. Mm-hmm. And Dan was actually telling us about doing, you know, I think it was the New Year's pelagic.
Yeah.
It's such an amazing place to do pelagics because, you know, the weather is generally, you know, pretty moderate and temperate. Like, it doesn't get a whole lot of snow and not like the freezing cold or anything like that. And I don't know, you can do a pelagic there any time of year and see something interesting.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So it was overall, we ended up with 44 species while we were out on the water. The one lifer, Scripps Murrelet, was super exciting for us. But 44 species for essentially half a day worth of birding, where you don't even have to move. You just stand, and the boat goes to the birds, and mm-hmm. then essentially the birds come to you because the boat's going around, and you're just standing there. So it's kind of a nice way to spend half a day. I think we were off the boat by 1-ish, 2-ish, something like that.
Yeah.
It was earlier than I thought it was going to be, which was nice, but because I was exhausted, if for anybody that has been on pelagics, or maybe somebody that people that haven't, like, it is surprisingly exhausting to just stand.
Yeah.
And even like sitting, standing, like you're not like hiking, but it is surprisingly exhausting to kind of make it all the way through the whole day.
But they did a great job at, you know, giving us opportunities to sit. There were chairs.
Oh yeah. There was lots of seating. Yeah. Lots of seating.
So that was really handy to be able to sit, because not all of them have seating that's easily accessible.
Yeah, it's true. We've been on a couple of projects where it's just like leaning on the rail is like as close to you get as you get to seating, to sitting.
Yeah, and I always find it funny, like the dichotomy of people that are on Pelagics. Like there's some people that just like do not care and they sit in the back and just enjoy being out on the ocean. You know, that's my vibe.
Yeah.
I just love being out there. But then you get the like really hardcore folks that like stand right at the bow of the ship and, you know, are like Jack and Rose, like in Titanic, you know, just hands out in the spray, like waiting for birds to come. And it's an interesting study of people too.
Yeah. I'm definitely in between those. The only reason I'm out there is to see the birds, because I get sick I'm always on the verge of getting sick. So I don't enjoy just sitting out there in the water, unfortunately. I wish I could, but I just can't.
So where do you prefer to be, the front or the back?
It really depends on the conditions. Like if there's a lot of birds, a lot of stuff to distract me, mm-hmm. like up at the front is good. But if it's just scanning through one bird here, one bird there, like yeah. I can't stand at the bow and do that.
Yeah.
I have to go to the stern and just wait near the back. For me, I've noticed that standing in the back is much better.
Mm-hmm.
The exhaust fumes don't bother me. So
when there
is exhaust fumes, that like this boat didn't have them. Like
no.
the way the exhaust was oriented, never had exhaust fumes the whole time.
Yeah.
But on some boats you do at the stern, and they don't bother me at all. So I feel better at the stern,
yeah.
even in the exhaust, than anywhere else. Some people prefer to stand right in the midship too, because that's usually the least amount of movement is the lowest deck midship. But
oh, sure, that makes sense.
But you know, to each their own. Where they need to be to enjoy it.
I enjoy sitting on the back and just like chilling at everything. But I also like to like be on the bow. I just don't like to fight for the front. You know, that really always is too much for me.
Yeah.
Like I don't want to elbow people out of the way, but I also want to be able to see things, and I'm shorter.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it kind of works out where I can stand on the rail and then you can stand behind me since
I can see right over you.
Yeah, I think yeah. you're tall enough that you can see over me.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I just look right over the top of your head.
Yep, exactly. So it was a great Pelagic. Like we said, it was really easy conditions. I'd definitely go on it again.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was a fun time. I'd like to go on other San Diego Pelagics to see, you know, the variation throughout the year.
Yeah.
I guess they do a New Year's one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That'd be fun to see what you get at the beginning of the year there.
Yeah, I wonder if they do anything like in the middle of summer.
Yeah, I don't know.
Interesting to look into.
Yeah, well, and there's a handful of Audubon societies, so they probably, you know, there's probably a number of different Pelagics for each one.
Maybe.
Yeah, so that might be a route if you want to go on a Pelagic on the West Coast to check out San Diego and see. Just type in, just Google San Diego Pelagics, and hopefully there's one when you're visiting. So there's definitely some opportunities to go on different Pelagics in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not a huge commitment or drive to go out there. And there's also whale watching tours too.
Oh,
so
tons of whale watching tours out there. If you don't get
on Pelagic trips, you might just be able to jump on a whale watching tour and see some species out of that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of ways to get on the water.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's San Diego, so there's lots of other birds around too.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of our very favorite places.
Yeah.
So that kind of wraps up our time in San Diego this year.
Yeah. So thank you guys all for listening to this podcast and the other podcasts that we talked about San Diego. We hope you enjoyed them and or learned something new. Please, please, please rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Music, or anywhere else that you listen to us. If you'd like to connect with us on the socials, please follow us at Hannah Goes Birding and Eric Goes Birding on Instagram, our Facebook page, Hannah and Eric Go Birding. You can email us at hannahandericgobirding@gmail.com. We're also, you can follow us on X. You can follow us on basically all the social media. Some Hannah and Eric Go Birding, Hannah and Eric, Eric Goes Birding, Hannah Goes Birding, something like that. Also, our website, www.gobirdingpodcast.com. Tell us what you like and share us and the love of birding with your friends.